Saturday, November 24th, Golden Boy Promotions presents Chuck Liddell as he takes on Tito Ortiz in the third and final chapter of their historic rivalry from the Forum. Tickets start at $30 and are available at Ticketmaster.com or by calling 800-745-3000.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, trying to find out what is up with the Utah Jazz and Tabocephalosha co-host Andrew D. Favalli. We have a mailbag for you on this Monday that we are recording on this early Sunday morning, but everything should still be relevant. Here's hoping that no breaking news comes to ruin what we've just recorded. Before we get started, though, just want to remind, beg, implore, plead with everyone to continue rating, reviewing, and subscribing to us on iTunes. We really love when we see those numbers go up. We even love when we see the reviews. If you have any constructive feedback, you can just give us the 5-star rating anyway and then leave whatever notes or things you want to see in the review section. You can also find us wherever podcasts are offered, and be sure to get at us on Twitter at Hardwood Knox. But again, the best way to just kind of help us gauge whether or not you like the pod that you're listening is to rate, review, and subscribe on iTunes. And if you've already done that, word of mouth, just spread it on Twitter, on Facebook. Is MySpace still a thing? Do it all up. Instagram, throw it out there. And now, before we actually get started, though, we have to ask, and it feels like forever since I asked this for some reason, but Andy, how are you doing?
Doing good. I love tearing into these mailbags, so that's always fun. I'm excited to answer some of these questions. How are you doing?
I'm spectacular. You know, you say the hypothetical trades are like my bread and butter. These mailbags are like your lifeblood.
I think I've exhausted random NBA thoughts from my own mind, so I need them to be like given to me.
I mean, based on your Twitter feed, I don't think you could ever exhaust the thoughts in your mind.
Yeah, the other day I was doing one of those stats threads and I thought, this is getting really repetitive with some of these teams. I might have to take like a week break or something and let stuff freshen up a little bit. But
wow, I think you just started a riot. Maybe not right this minute, but once we publish, people are going to be upset.
It was nice to get these questions though, because they do always make me think about things that I'm not necessarily thinking about. We generally get pretty good questions when we put
and we out. Really should thank everyone who, because you send it to me and then I'll retweet it from the NBA Math account, which has more followers than either of us. Although I think you might be closing in on them because you're super popular and I'm not.
So they're still growing.
But when you sent it to me, I retweeted it within it had to be 2 minutes of the text message and you already had 15 replies. So people come to you for this shit, which is just spectacular.
Well, I'm glad they do, because like I said, we really do get good questions from this.
This is your thing, though. This is your show, so can you please lead us?
All right, I'm going to start us with Micah Adams, at Micah Adams 13. This was an interesting question to me. Maybe it's just because Kemba went off for 60 last night and Doncic hit a game winner. But he says, better player in 2021, Kemba Walker or Luka Doncic? I'll throw it to you first.
All right, here's my thing. I think, and this was something that was going around Twitter. I can't remember. I think it was Chris Towers from, he's at CBS, was talking about whether Kemba Walker and Kyrie Irving are the same player or who is better or something like that. And I think he put it best is that Kyrie Irving is probably better than Kemba Walker. Defensively, I'm not so sure. Kemba's always been a little bit of an underrated defender. But the perception of them, the difference in perception is just far greater than reality because Kemba is so close to that good. And yeah, that's what makes this question so tough to me. And I saw this too, and I didn't really, not that I didn't give it much thought, but I would go with Luka. And this
me too.
I knew you would go with Luka. And this isn't a barometer for anything, but, and I don't want to look at one shot as this defining thing, but when you look at everything else Luka does, and then the shots that he's taking as a rookie, he is shooting 33.3% on step back three-pointers. And that doesn't seem like a super high number. Again, he's a teenager in the NBA taking step back three-pointers at all. 11.
He probably takes like one or two of those a game.
Right. He's averaging about more than two a game right now. He's 11 of 33 on the season. And so that's like, that's absurd to me. And then when you combine that with his youth, how he's going to improve as a passer, I imagine he'll get in better shape. But when you just are able to do that as a rookie, he's been good as advertised, if not better. And it's tough for me when we're talking about two seasons from now, right? Kemba Walker is going to be 30. Then I just don't. Maybe it'll be close, and Kemba's been fantastic. He wasn't supposed to get this good, but it would be a little bit surprising. Is that even too strong of a word? If Luka wasn't better by that point,
yeah, I would probably be a little bit surprised. I think that's a fair word to use there. I agree with everything.
For context, by the way, James Harden is shooting 34.2% on step back threes this year.
Yeah, it's incredible what Luka's done so far. I have a lot of the same reasons for picking him. Kemba's been amazing. I'm going to reference the same sort of stuff that you did about him and Kyrie. I know you saw my quote tweet of that Chris Towers tweet.
Because I retweeted
that
it.
Kemba and Kyrie have had basically the same box plus minus over the last 4 years. Kyrie's is 3.8 and Kemba's is 3.7. I agree with Chris and I agree with you that he's probably better than people realize. But like you said, 2020-21 is going to be his age 30 season. He's undersized for a point guard. Those two things, age and size, and I think that probably is about when he'll start his decline. I don't know how steep that decline will be. Maybe he'll still be really solid for 4 or 5 years after that. That's very possible. But that's generally when those smaller point guards start to slow down a little bit. And Luka Doncic, meanwhile, will be in his third season at that point, which is a lot of times when star players kind of take off.
That's a good point.
And he just sort of fits the modern game much better than Kemba Walker does. He is a playmaking wing, which is going to be huge over the next several years, I think. He's got excellent size. Who did he block at the rim the other day?
Michael Jordan.
He swatted somebody at the rim the other day, and I just almost couldn't believe it. We were sold this idea that he didn't have the athleticism to play at this level, which you know that I always thought that was kind of stupid.
Wait till he's going to be the new Kevin Love, does the most with the least.
Yeah, he's looked better than even I anticipated.
Wow.
This season, he's averaging 20.7 points, 7 rebounds, and 4.5 assists per 75 possessions. I know you love when I go there. There's only been 86 seasons from 31 players in the history of the NBA that hit all three of those marks, and none of those seasons came from teenagers up until Luka Doncic. So he's off to a ridiculous start. He should only get better over the next 2 or 3 years. Very cliche, but sky's the limit for Luka Doncic.
Wow, that was a week ending. That's what you're talking about. He can basically play positions 1 through 4. I know the defensive matchups are going to matter because he's not super quick. He can't chase around these superstars in the half court. But if he gets just in, I don't want to say he's out of shape because he's playing in the NBA at a high level already at the age of 19. But if he just gets stronger and just his stamina improves and he can get a little bit faster, that's someone that all of a sudden can play positions 1 through 4. We've already seen him play the 3 and the 4, unofficially the 2, functions like a 1. It's just, you talked about how huge that's going to be. That just seems like the direction of the NBA right now. And the direction of the NBA like changes every 3 or 4 years at this point, every half decade or whatever. But he is the archetype for the player that you want to build your team around. You probably want someone a little bit more explosive on the defensive end. I don't think you need anything more from him on the offensive end, but he's basically just the new ideal archetype.
By the way, the guy that he stonewalled at the rim the other day was Derek Favors, who's generally a really, really good finisher. He's good Favors. All right, Dave Leonardis at Mr. Leonardis. Not really a question, but name a player we adored during his pre-Twitter prime that we wouldn't be as fond of if he played today. And if you don't have one teed up on that one, I do. I'm going with Allen Iverson, who was very, very good, obviously. He took sort of a ragtag bunch of players in the 76ers all the way to an NBA Finals where they lost to the Lakers. But everyone is picked apart in today's NBA, in the Twitter NBA, like Dave mentions. He would have been very, very divisive. I think he would have been sort of the opposite end of the spectrum of Nikola Jokic, where maybe the numbers guys wouldn't give him the proper due and the eye test guys would maybe overrate him a little bit. Again, basically just the inverse of what's going on with Nikola Jokic right now. But here's my numbers to back this up. And this was kind of interesting to me. Iverson's five-year peak was 26.7 points, 5 assists, 3.9 rebounds, and 2.3 steals per 75 possessions, 5.09 true shooting, 3.9 box plus minus, 4.3 offensive box plus minus, and 0.148 win shares per 48 minutes. And this will look a lot better when I tweet it because this is a lot of numbers in a audio format. But Lou Williams' last five seasons, 24 points, 4.4 assists, 3.1 rebounds, 1.4 steals per 75 possessions, 0.576 true shooting, 0.7 box plus minus, but 3.6 offensive box plus minus, and 0.135 win shares per 48. Again, you guys can't see those numbers right now like I can, but it's basically just a little step below on everything from Allen Iverson to Lou Williams. And I think Lou Williams he certainly gets plenty of respect in today's NBA. He's a Sixth Man of the Year winner. I think he has a lot of fans out there. I think most people realize what he's done for the Clippers over the last couple years. But Allen Iverson was touted, I think, by a lot of people as like a top five player for much of his career. And his numbers aren't like overwhelmingly better than the last five seasons of Lou Williams. So I think we might have a much, much different perception of Allen Iverson if he was in this era where everything is just picked apart piece by piece by piece.
That's a fantastic pick. I have no arguments there. I want to know, does Kobe Bryant count during the pre-Twitter era?
Mm-hmm. I thought about him too.
It's him. And he kind of, his career kind of intersected with the social media explosion.
Best years definitely pre-NBA Twitter, though.
And he was just never the most efficient scorer, and a lot of the stuff about him seems more myth than rooted in facts. The other thing for me would be, and I don't necessarily want to get too deep in this podcast, the relative pass that he gets from the alleged rape in Colorado is... it's still mind-blowing to me, and there have been pieces written about this, but I don't think if social media was far more popular back then that we collectively, and I probably blame myself for overlooking this at points or not thinking enough about it, maybe it's still, because we still see athletes get a relative pass there, but the way that he's just allowed to, not allowed, but doesn't have to talk about it, and it's almost viewed as this footnote or an asterisk, and it should be bigger than that. And so I think that would have contributed to how we perceived Kobe Bryant more so in the modern years. My other pick would be, and this is based completely on functionality, would be Antoine Walker. I don't think in the social media era that he ever would have been an all-star.
He would have been, yeah. He might not have.
He was just touted as like this great shooter. Yeah. He shot 32.5% from beyond the arc for his career. His best season shooting from beyond the arc, 36.9%, which in 1998-1999 is whatever, but he only cleared 30.
What's his career percentage?
From three? 32.5%.
Yeah. Sheesh.
Even better, his effective field goal percentage for his career. Do you care to take a gander? I'm going to give you an over-under.
Based on that 32.9%. I'm going to say under.
Okay, it's over. I did that on purpose because I didn't get it right. 46.1.
Yeah, that's bad.
His true shooting percentage. Let's see if you get this. 49.
I'll go under again.
Okay, it's under. 48.4. Couldn't believe there.
He probably would have been a punchline in today's NBA. There would have been so many jokes about I mean, I don't even know. He was almost the punchline at the time that he played. So he's certainly been torn to pieces now.
Yeah, three-time All-Star. I will say he never made an All-NBA team. He made All-Rookie, if you want to count that. But I just don't – for what he was supposed to be, he really never actually was.
Yeah, I remember that one season when the Mavericks signed him, Antoine Jameson. I think they still had Nash at the time. They had Dirk, obviously. I think Michael Finley might have even still been on that team. And I remember reading some article in Sports Illustrated about how they were completely fine with winning games like 150 to 140. Antoine Walker was really something else. I have a friend who's a big Celtics fan who just loved him and would probably be appalled by this conversation right now.
He didn't turn the ball over a lot. Got to give him that.
There's a good silver lining for Twan Walker. This one's from
Can you believe how much time he actually spent at small forward in parts of his career too?
What does it say?
It's for his career, it was 12%, which is just way too high, but towards the end of his career when he was in Miami, he was playing a third or almost half of his minutes there depending on the season.
Oh my gosh. Yeah, that's nonsense. He could not survive on the wing nowadays, that's for sure. The at @Reddit_Jazz account. have you noticed the Jazz's free throw issues this season?
What is he referring to?
That's actually my question. Oh. They've been terrible. I think they were 26th before last night's game. And I'm almost certain it got worse after last night. They're now 28th in free throw percentage, 71%.
But don't they get to the – I didn't check this. But don't they lead the league in free throw rate? I need to look.
They're up there because of how many free throws that Rudy shoots. They are first in free throw rate, 35%. So first in free throw rate, but 28th in free throw percentage. If they were even like average in free throw percentage, that would be a big strength of theirs. But that's all to preface @Reddit_Jazz's question, which is the gang seemed to start turning the woes from the line away towards the end of the second half there. He's referencing the Boston game. As a former player, how do players, let alone teams as a whole, break out of a free throw slump and return to the average? And I just tagged this question because my freshman year of college, I remember I was in like a season-long competition with another guy on the team to see who would miss a free throw first. And I was like 90% from the line through probably the first three quarters of the season. And then I tailed off and finished around like 80%. Then in my sophomore year, I dropped down into the 70s. And then in my junior year, I missed the season with a torn ACL. And then my senior year, are you ready for this?
Oh, I'm ready. I think you've told me this before, too.
I shot 25% from the free throw line senior in college. It was
– Chris Dudley would be so proud.
the fall off, the drop off from my first year playing college basketball to my last was just immense. And it was completely a mental thing. I knew it was at the time. And understandably, my coach would pull me in like the end of games that last year. And I think that might have contributed to it. If I was a coach, I would try to let players play through that kind of stuff. And I didn't have an assistant like really pull me aside and work with me on it until right towards the end of the season. And then I broke my hand right after that. So who knows if what he had told me would have helped or not. But I know this has been kind of a debate in the NBA too. When teams were really employing the hack of whoever strategy, I think it was Doc Rivers with DeAndre Jordan wanted to keep him in and kind of empower him and see if he could play through it. I don't know if there's an exact answer, but I think what you got to do beyond the obvious, like just get in the gym and shoot a ton of free throws and, you know, repetition. But you just have to let guys play through it. And when the whole team is missing free throws like the Jazz, they don't really have a choice. So they're just going to have to work through it. I don't know if that's a great answer, maybe you hire a sports psychologist or something. The little tip that helped me at the end of my senior year was to, he showed me a clip of Ray Allen shooting free throws and how he leaned in on his free throws. And I guess I was leaning back for some reason. And when I like really focus on leaning in as I shoot free throws, it's a lot better. So maybe there's little like mechanical tweaks you can do here and there. But for the most part, I think it's definitely a mental thing when a guy can't make free throws. And I'm no psychologist, but generally speaking, I think you just got to play through it.
Who are you most disappointed on the Jazz with their free throw shooting? And I think the easy answer might be Gobert or Favors, but they've never really been lights out free throw shooters for their careers.
Let me pull up their free throw percentages.
I'm going to tell you mine. I want to know why. I know he doesn't go there often. He's never attempted 100 free throws in a single season, despite only missing one game over the past 3 years and only missing four games over the past 5 years combined. Joe Ingles.
It's weird.
He should be shooting like 98% from the line with the way he hits his three-pointers, particularly from the corner. And he's at 64.3% this year. Again, gets there under 2 times per 36 minutes. But I've never really understood, and I kind of forgot about it last year because he shot close to 80%. And again, he doesn't get there often, but you just look at how accurate he is from the three-point line, and he just looks like a dude that should be shooting 85, 90% from the charity stripe.
His free throw percentage has always confused me. That's a good one to peg. Dante Exum is a guy that he's not a good shooter. Obviously, I think everybody knows that. But he is pretty good at getting to the line the last couple years. And if he wants to raise his ceiling a bit, if he could become like an 80 to 85% free throw shooter, I think that would change an awful lot for him. Donovan Mitchell's at 80% right now. That's probably fine, but he can, I mean, every one of these guys, if they just improved like 2 or 3%, it could have a pretty big impact. One guy who I keep waiting to see if he's going to get more time this season, because he's just been really good or really solid anyways, Alec Burks. He's shooting 87% from the line. He's always had a pretty high free throw rate. This season, it's 435. I wonder what he is for his career. It's probably right around there. I've always felt like he does a good job of getting to the line. Career free throw rate is just below 400, and he takes over 5 free throw attempts per 36 minutes. They've had some games where they look very, very stagnant offensively, and I'm really starting to wonder what a Burks Mitchell backcourt might look like, but that's certainly a different discussion.
Ricky Rubio effect. Ricky Rubio is hysterical because he's shooting for his career, and I know
his career is crazy. Yeah,
I know there are players on the court for this stat, but for his career, he's shooting 48.3% at the rim, and he's shooting 83.6% from the foul line.
Yeah,
and that's the distance. The gap is just crazy. And this season, it's basically his shooting percentage at the rim is like half of what he's shooting at the foul line. And again, I get that her defense is on the court, but you normally would see guys, when they're in, especially if they're hitting a bunch of shots at the foul line, when they're inside 3 feet, are probably going to shoot in the 60s to high 60s at the rim.
His shooting percentages are so weird. If you look up like career leaderboards for true shooting percentage and effective field goal percentage, he's among the all time worst in both, but it's significantly better for true shooting percentage just because that free throw percentage has buoyed that number really his entire career. And he's like sneakily pretty good at getting to the line too. Let's see here. I'm
over 4.3 attempts per 36 minutes this year, which is solid.
But yeah, they've got an issue with free throws. And like I said, if they could just get up to like the middle of the league and maintain that free throw rate, that would probably boost their offensive rating by a couple points a game. And that could be huge for them. At Alex V reporting, Alex, I'm going to guess it's Vihar. We'll see if he corrects me on that. How long till LeBron runs out of patience? Losing to Orlando tonight has to be tough for those guys. I'll let you take this one first.
Well, first of all, the Magic have just been beating randomly good teams. Or maybe not.
Yeah.
They beat the Spurs. Who else have they beaten? I should look this up. So it's not
I think they're solid.
Yeah, they're not. I don't know what they're going to end up by the end of the season, but losing to the Magic is not some massive embarrassment. And can we chill? The Lakers just came off a 4-game winning streak. They were on the road. And you know what they say about the Orlando nightlife. Disney World's open late. No, I'm just... But I just... If you're LeBron, you can't... To me, you can't run out of patience this year. And I think the Lakers are still going to be a playoff team. If he want... Their defense had gotten better until they gave up 180 million points to the Magic on Saturday night. I just don't... I don't know how... If they go on... If there's a point where they lose five in a row, then maybe we'll see him get impatient. But even then, I don't know what they're going to do. Not at least before December, after December 14th, when they can start moving some of their expiring contracts. And even then, I don't know if they're willing. They're one, probably not willing to take on long-term money. And two, I don't know how many first-round picks they're willing to give up or if they're willing to trade any of their youngsters. I would have to imagine Josh Hart is just off-limits at this point. And I would guess that at least two of Kuzma, Ingram, and Ball are off limits for them. Unless we're talking about Anthony Davis, but Anthony Davis is not going to be available this season, so Lakers fans could just give up that pipe dream. It's just, I don't see him reaching that point, and if he does, I don't think it's going to be where Cleveland sold off half their team at the trade deadline last year. I don't think it's going to be this huge star acquisition, just because the Lakers as a team want to conserve their cap space. And I don't know what can you get for a bunch of expiring contracts and a pick, really? I just don't, you're not going to get Kemba for that either. So I think they'll make moves. Maybe they'll be active on the buyout market. Maybe they'll trade for a veteran at the deadline who's on an expiring contract or really has really cheap money for 2019, 2020. But I don't see him really running out of patience. And if he does, that's inexplicable to me, just because, as he's even said, he's supposed to know what he's getting into at this point. And you're not going to beat the Warriors anyway. So.
Yeah. I think we've said that on this podcast a few times, that if he didn't know that this was going to be a up and down season, then that's on him. He should have known that. And my first response to that question when I read it was, what do they even do at this point? Maybe Kemba Walker is slightly more gettable now than he was at the beginning of the season. I'm not sure. I think Damian Lillard is certainly less gettable now than he was at the start of the season.
You know what we're not talking about enough with the Blazers, though, is that, let's just say they flame out in the playoffs again this season. If the Warriors are going to disband and they've managed to kind of weather this storm, now after this year, you only have a year left on Evan Turner's contract. As Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum get set for free agency in 2020? Is it 2021 for both of them? It's the same year, I believe. They're going to have cap space then. It's got to be 2020. No, 2021. It's just... What my point is that if you wait out the Warriors being the Warriors as of right now, there's a chance you'll have cap space next summer, the year before Lillard and McCollum hit free agency. And you can sell yourself on doing more things in the West with this group if the Warriors disband, but then knowing that you're so close to being able to make significant upgrades on the roster, potentially. Sorry, go ahead, though. That was just we've kind of, a lot of people have killed Neil O'Shea for keeping this team together, but if that's the result where they're going to contend for a top four seed in the West, and even if they keep getting bounced in the first round, if you wait out Golden State, even if they just lose Kevin Durant, it's not Durant and Draymond Green, I don't know if you've done your job, but you've put yourself in a pretty good position.
Yeah, I think that's all true. And I don't think they're going to break up that core this season is the not point. I would be surprised if the Lakers end up with Damian Lillard. I'll just say that this season. I think we also mentioned the idea of trading for Vucevic at some point, which I still think is an interesting possibility. Maybe they get to a point where they want to make a deal later in the season, and Orlando wants to lean a little bit harder into the tank and give more minutes to Mo Bamba. Maybe that's something that they could kick around in a couple months. But that's generally my answer. They're probably still a couple months away if he loses patience, and he should have known going in that this was going to be an interesting experiment, at least for the first year.
And I wonder if they would be willing to trade for kind of an overpriced veteran that might potentially hit the buyout market, because I don't know that they're going to be a buyout destination. If you're This would be a perfect example. We've talked about him in the podcast before. If it's Trevor Ariza, what if you're giving up KCP for Trevor Ariza? Or even if it's maybe you're even able to give up less. You don't have to give up KCP. You can give up two of your expirings. Rondo plus filler would work. And then like a whatever pick just to get Trevor Ariza, because I don't know that he would sign with you should he reach the buyout market, because yes, you're not going to be able him to really, if he wants to go after money, then he seems like someone who'll do that over the summer, but he's already got his bag this year. I would think he would go to a contender, and the Lakers, while you could probably talk yourself into them maybe beating any team that isn't the Warriors, you'd want to go somewhere that has a better chance of beating Golden State. And maybe that's something they could look at, whether it's Trevor Ariza, maybe Damari Carroll is playing well, although I don't know if Brooklyn would want to get rid of him. But that seems to be, unless they're really going to empty their treasure chest or dangle it, that seems to be kind of the ceiling on a move.
Yeah. And I think I would rather, if I'm the Lakers, and I obviously don't know if they feel this way, I'd want to just let the young guys continue to take their lumps and see what they look like after a full season with LeBron. Continue to play a bunch of minutes to Josh Hart, Brandon Ingram, Kyle Kuzma, Lonzo Ball. And if you want to do something drastic, wait for the summer. That would be the approach that I would take.
And in case anyone's wondering, I have not yet sold my KCP stock. So getting close, though, I think.
I feel like mildly in on KCP, too. I vacillate on that one. Jacob, @Jacob_NBA. True or false, De'Aaron Fox will be the best point guard from the 2017 draft class.
I actually wrote about this minimally a couple weeks back, and I think the only one who, unless Markel Fultz gets a lot better, the only one who I could really see rivaling De'Aaron Fox at this point is Lonzo Ball.
This season, Fox, he's taken off. That Grant Hughes story that you sent me yesterday was awesome, and that's one that people should check out. Go to Grant Hughes' Twitter timeline and look for the De'Aaron Fox article. But he's averaging 20 points, 7 assists, and 4 rebounds, basically. His true shooting percentage is right around 60. It's a huge leap. Some of these numbers could come down a little bit, but he looks very much for real. To me, I'm just going to rattle off some box plus minuses of point guards from that draft class this season. Fox is at 1.8. Lonzo, 0.4. I'm going to throw Donovan Mitchell in there, even though he's a shooting guard. I still think there's a chance he ends up playing point guard. He's minus 0.6 this season. Frank Ntilikina, minus 4.4. Who am I missing? Dennis Smith, minus 3.2. Is that it? Fultz? He's minus 3.
And De'Aaron Fox is shooting, by the way, 42.3% from beyond the arc on 3.3 attempts per game. He's also shooting above 38% on pull-up three-pointers, which account for almost a fifth of his shot attempts. So
he looks really good. Point guard was, I think, probably the most hyped position of that draft class, with good reason. The top two picks were point guards. Dennis Smith went high on the lottery. Fox went high on the lottery. So to emerge from that much hyped group as the best would be quite a little feather in his cap, and I think it's absolutely possible for De'Aaron Fox.
Yeah, it's as of right now, he is the best point guard from his draft class. It's a matter of
maintaining. Yeah, if we stop now, he would be. Yeah, for sure. All right.
Quick, too. He's so fast.
Yeah, he's really explodes off those pick and rolls. There's some good clips in that Grant Hughes story, too. And there's a good quote about it from Vlade Divac on his quickness.
@GT_Hughes, if you want to check out his piece.
I'm glad you did that, because I couldn't remember where the underscore was. I'm going to combine a couple questions on this next one. Misser of Cov, I'm assuming this is a 76ers fan who misses Robert Covington, @any_bull. What do you have to say to people who believe Durant is better than Curry? And then Sam Teets @NextBigSportGuy, more essential player to a championship team, Curry or Durant? And I'll let you take this one first.
Okay, so there's just the difference the way that Curry operates, one, is something that I think is undersold. Durant prefers to operate inside the arc, which is fine, and he's always shot the three ball well. But where defenses have to pick up Curry, they could technically do that for Durant too, but that's just not – he's not going to take a 30-footer off the dribble that like as often as Curry is. And there's just an inherent pull there, and that's going to just open up things for the offense even more. I went deeper, though, and so I looked up their minutes without each other since Durant came to the team. And so when Curry plays without Durant, he's totaled, since Durant came to the Warriors, 1,570 minutes. The Warriors' average net rating in that time, 13.9. When Durant plays without Curry over these same two-plus seasons, 1,885 minutes, so about 300 minutes and change more than Curry, the Warriors' net rating during these minutes is 2.6. I looked at the same span, two-plus seasons, when they play as the only star. No Draymond, no Klay, and they don't have the – if you're Curry, you don't have Durant. If you're Durant, you don't have Curry. Mm-hmm. Curry, during this span, has played 217 minutes of, I'll call it, me time. The Warriors' average net rating, 12.2. Durant has played 407 minutes of me time. The Warriors' average net rating during this time, minus 4.9. And I'm not going to use that one for their playoffs because the sample sizes are so ridiculously small for both of them. They're both sub 70 minutes total. But in the playoffs, so two postseason campaigns, Curry has totaled 253 minutes without Durant. Golden State's average net rating during that time, 13.4. Kevin Durant has totaled 392 postseason minutes without Curry. Golden State's average net rating during that time, 1.9. And if it's a matter of who do you want taking the last shot because Durant can more easily rise over defenders, that's an okay argument, but that doesn't sway the entire picture then. This whole thing that you can stop Curry, yeah, maybe you can impede his individual efficiency. You cannot change the impact he has on the way a defense approaches the entire game. That's just never going to change, whether he's making shots or not, because the idea of Stephen Curry – the idea, not Stephen Curry himself, the idea of Stephen Curry is the single biggest non-LeBron threat in the NBA. And it might even exceed LeBron at some point. Probably not because he's incredible, but I'm just saying the idea, just the concept of Stephen Curry and what he does is the scariest non-LeBron thing in the NBA.
Yeah, those are excellent numbers. I agree with all that. To add to your very first point, in addition to having to pick Curry up like 30 feet from the rim, there's also a lot less ISO when he's the main guy. So that's another thing that makes it a little bit more difficult to fall asleep on defense when it's, you know, just Curry as opposed to just Durant. If he, and then on your last point, if he stays healthy and plays at this level for the next two or three seasons, he's going to have the best offensive box plus minus in NBA history. He's rapidly closing in on LeBron there. And then over the last since Durant joined the Wizards, since Durant joined the Warriors.
Foreshadowing, is that what was it?
Curry tops Durant comfortably in box plus minus. They're basically dead even in win shares, 248, 244 for Curry, 243 for Durant, and pretty even in true shooting percentage too, 647, 643. I think your numbers illustrate this a lot better, that they're just better when he's on and Durant's off than they are when Durant's on and he's off. He is a – there. So many different people have described his offensive impact in so many different ways, and I think at the end of the day, he's going to have an argument for being the best offensive player in NBA history. I really do believe that.
He's already a top 25 player of all time, right?
I would put him even higher than that.
Yeah. I'm trying to be not so incendiary. I would put him higher, but I know everyone's ranking's better, but that he's a top 25 player. Like if we just cut through the bullshit, he's top 20, maybe even top 15 already. And there's a chance that he's going to be top 10.
Yeah. And, somebody put it this way on Twitter and I can't remember who it was, but He's the best shooter of all time. I think that's pretty much accepted. There may be a few outlying people here and there who take somebody else. But best shooter of all time, possibly the best offensive player of all time. That's a guy who's got to be in like the top 10 to 15 conversation. And I'd already have him there. And like you said, I could see him rising even higher. It's just, it's crazy.
And for anyone who thinks that I was just deliberately leaving out the small me time numbers in the playoffs, both Durant and Curry, when they play alone, are getting absolutely slaughtered in the postseason. Curry's net rating during those two seasons, -19.9. Durant's is a -11.9. So if you would, again, and we're talking about combined, that's less than 80 minutes. So just in case anyone thought I was just trying to skew the numbers in Curry's favor, they're both absolutely terrible when they're on their own in the postseason.
Yeah, I think those numbers very comfortably back Curry. Our next question comes from Corey DeMoss at CoreyDemoss. Where does Steven Adams rank among the NBA centers right now?
Ooh, I'm going to throw this to you, Mr. Rudy Gobert fan.
The only centers right now who have more wins over replacement than Adams are Jokic, Anthony Davis, Rudy Gobert, Joel Embiid, and Nikola Vucevic. I don't know if I'll put an exact number on Steven Adams. I'd say he's probably a top 10 center right now. I think that's safe. One thing that's been interesting to me this season is how much better OKC's been with him on the floor. Right now they're plus 11.6 points per 100 possessions. That's 95th percentile when he's on the floor. And then they're -6.3 points per 100 possessions, 22nd percentile when he's off. Those are from cleaning the glass. He's been more of a net rating swing than Russell Westbrook so far this season for the Thunder. So he's quietly had a really, really strong season. I think he's averaging around 16 and 10. He's doing his typical domination of the offensive boards. He doesn't get a lot of blocks, but he's a really smart positional defender. He's extremely strong.
Is there a big who slips screens better than him in the NBA today?
He is amazing at that. That's a great thing to bring up. This is a cop-out, but I'm going to say he's comfortably top 10.
So Adam Fermel and I, when we did Bleacher Report's top 100 players, ranked him ninth among centers. And here, this is going into the season, so maybe perception of this has changed, but here are the bigs we put in front of him. Clint Capella, Andre Drummond, I think there's probably a big case to be made there, Al Horford, Karl Anthony Towns, Nikola Jokic, Rudy Gobert, Joel Embiid, and Anthony Davis is a center. And anyone who doesn't think that should just stop at this point.
Especially this season, yeah.
I would say there's arguable points to be made about Drummond. Maybe the on-off numbers hate Clint Capella this year, FYI, but I think we know better. So
yeah, they love Isaiah Hartenstein.
Yeah, so it's just, if you want to say Drummond, I know some people will probably say Al Horford too at this point. I'm not there yet, but he's top 10, obviously, and you could probably make a top 7 case for him if you really wanted to.
I think that's fair. All right, anything else on Steven Adams?
His accent is fantastic.
He is one of the funniest guys in the league. I really want to get him into some kind of a movie at some point in his life. Ooh. Do you know about Taika Waititi?
No.
He's a director, and he's from New Zealand, and he's done some really funny stuff. He was behind the show Flight of the Conchords, which I love. This, you will know, he directed Thor Ragnarok.
Fantastic movie.
And he also voiced who's the big rock guy? It looks kind of like The Thing, but he just had a bunch of funny one-liners from that movie. What's his name?
Oh, my God. I have no idea.
You know who I'm talking about, though,
yes,
right?
Yes, he's like the – I can't even remember. That's Google rock guy from Thor.
That's Taika Waititi. He directed the movie, and then he voiced that his character.
Korg,
that's right. We got to get Steven Adams into a Taika Waititi movie. That just has to happen.
Officially on board, and I didn't even know that this was a conversation that was going to happen. It seems like you've given real thought to it, though, which is spectacular.
Oh, I have. Every time Steven Adams plays. So, Andrew Beckner. This is another combo question. And then at @Mark_Trova. Andrew's question is more upside / who would you want going forward, Lonzo Ball or Trae Young? And then Mark's question is, Lonzo Ball just bad? First, I answered that second one quickly. The answer is no. I'm still in on Lonzo Ball. Second question, I think Lonzo Ball has more upside than Trae Young as well. Rookie Lonzo, 1.7 box plus minus, 0.053 win shares per 48 minutes. Rookie Trae Young, minus 4.6 box plus minus, and minus 0.019 win shares per 48 minutes. It's extremely rare to be in the negatives in win shares per 48 minutes. I think people are rightfully still high on Trae Young. I'm not sure people are talking enough at how just awful his shooting has been. He's taking six threes a game and shooting 24% from three. And there's, like I said, there's still things to be excited about. He's a great distributor, 7.8 assists in fewer than 30 minutes. But we now have, I've done this, run these numbers before. You can even include the second half of his college season, summer league, all of the professional organized basketball that he's played, the shooting is bad. It's just really, really bad. And maybe it turns around at some point, but there's also got to be a point where people got to start to be concerned. So I'm not out on Trae Young. I just think there's more reason for concern than most people are showing right now.
Okay, so Lonzo Ball is not bad. I'll back up that point. I'm going to respectfully disagree, though, about who has more upside. The thing that concerns me about Lonzo Ball, and I don't think this is purely the after effect of him playing alongside LeBron James, he is so passive on the offensive end to a fault. He's shooting more threes, hitting a higher percentage of his threes, but he is still hesitant to fire away. He doesn't attack. His drives have basically been slashed in half this year, and it's just that's a larger percentage than should come down based on playing with LeBron and seeing your minutes diminish. It's just he doesn't enter that attack mode. And for Trae Young, shooting percentages are in the toilet. The types of shots he is taking are ridiculously difficult. His handle is spectacular. The Hawks, I like the way they play offense, but they don't have a lot of offensive talent right now. They're dead last in offensive efficiency. I don't think that's on Trae Young. And here's, we talk about his shooting, but the way he's finishing at the rim and creating on drives, people were concerned.
That's better than I expected, for sure.
Yeah, because of his length. So 108 players are averaging at least five drives per game. Trae Young is 10th in shooting percentage among all those players. He's shooting a larger percentage on drives than Stephen Curry is. And that's 57.3% for anyone who wants the exact numbers. That's absurd. So I think we're talking about a rookie, and I know Lonzo Ball's only a sophomore, but even when we've tried to weigh defensive impact, you always go back to the player who is more of an alpha on offense because they can intrinsically, to me, impact the game more. And while Lonzo Ball could be a really good defender, great passer, if he's never going to have that scoring mentality to the point where he is still, not the word afraid, maybe it's just hesitant or reluctant, reticent to shoot catch and fire three-pointers, that's a problem. And so give me the guy who's going to be a real defensive magnet when you combine it with his vision. And while the shots aren't falling right now, we both tend to throw efficiency out the window when we're talking about rookies and sophomores. So forget their shooting percentages, but their styles and just the way Trae Young's fearlessness to me and how he gets into the lane and how he's not reticent to do these things against defenses, I think that's going to hold more value long-term.
Yeah, I would just default to at some point he has to start making shots. I know that was the excuse at Oklahoma too, that he had bad teammates and he has to take these shots. And maybe at some point we think, well,
Trae Young is 16 games into his NBA career.
I know. He just has to make shots at some point. And I will also say that to me, Lonzo Ball is still one of the most enjoyable passers to watch. He hasn't had a chance to do it as much this season for obvious reasons. I just love the way he always goes for the hit ahead pass. He doesn't dominate the ball. He always sees the open man. He seems to see the open man like a second before most guys do. And then the defensive ceiling on those two is just worlds different. Like I said, I'm not out on Trae Young, but I think if I had to pick between the two, I would probably go with Lonzo.
Trae Young, 43%+ of his shots are contested. It's just, that's crazy.
Maybe he needs to improve his decision-making a little bit.
Wow. Who? Okay. who can you name me? Because I know you can name the second leading scorer. Name the Hawks' top three scorers for me.
It's got to be Torian Prince. It's got to be one. And then Kent Bazemore?
Yeah.
Hey, there you go.
But that's you're just,
that's for sure.
You're proving my point there.
Mario at MTRC_2. How does Ayton compare to Jaren? And I'm assuming he means Jackson, Wendell, Carter, and Bamba, Mo Bamba. I could throw a lot of different numbers out. I made the point earlier that they don't necessarily translate in audio, so maybe I'll just point or post them as a tweet later. My general answer to this question is I mentioned earlier that last year's draft class was really heavy on good guards, or at least it looked to be heavy on good guards. We'll see how they turn out. This season's draft class is loaded with intriguing big men. Bamba, Jackson, Carter, Ayton, and I'll throw Mitchell Robinson in there, are all comfortably above average in box plus minus right now. Ayton's a much better passer than I thought he would be. Wendell Carter is doing the things that I kind of expected. Lots of assists, lots of blocks. His efficiency, I think, will get better over the course of the season. Jaren Jackson looks extremely confident. He's getting a bunch of blocks too. Mitchell Robinson actually leads this group in box plus minus and win shares per 48 minutes. Bamba leads this, or Robinson leads this group in blocks too. I was going to say Bamba did, but Robinson does. Bamba is averaging over 3 blocks per 75 possessions. There's a lot to like about all of these guys. I think this draft class is loaded with solid bigs. I'm not necessarily sure you can go wrong with any of them.
It's Jaren Jackson's interesting. He, of that bunch, maybe with the exception of Wendell Carter, he should be the best defensive player of that group, right?
He's excellent on defense, yeah.
The other thing I wonder is, and maybe at some point, he's a rookie right now playing for a team that's trying to get to the playoffs, but they need to let him do more on offense at some point. And the other thing is, can we just get him fewer minutes alongside Kyle Anderson? Because when you have him at the three, or even at the, unless Jared, you could go 4 and 5 with him and Jaren Jackson Jr. might be something they want to explore more than they have this season. And I think the numbers, last time I checked on that combination, aside from it being a ridiculously small sample size, just weren't great. But he is, like, right now, he has not been unleashed in the way that, you know, an Ayton has been allowed to, or even Mo Bamba to some extent, but Mo Bamba hasn't really been unleashed either. And so there's the potential for me, if not ironclad right now, where he could be the best offensive player in that group. But I know Ayton kind of throws a wrench in that because, as you said, he is a better passer than anyone thought coming in, or at least you thought, and by extension me. But Jaren Jackson seems like he's going to be smooth off the dribble at some point. His effective field goal percentage, by the way, when using between 3 and 6 dribbles this season, is 60. Which is just super impressive. It accounts for, you know, most of his shots are coming with one dribble or less, but still. I really like Jaren Jackson Jr. I would like, though, to see him in more of a featured offensive role. And I don't know how long it's going to take for him to get there with Memphis, just when you have Conley and you have Conley, you have Marc Gasol, and there's just the nature.
Playing well.
Yeah.
Paperverse. And I failed to include his at. Michael Bridges should start over Ariza going forward, right? Bridges comfortably better in box plus minus, more than doubles Ariza's win shares per 48. Almost 8% better in true shooting, and almost triples Ariza's steal percentage. I thought this 2 or 3 months ago that the Suns should just start all the young guys and let them work through their take their lumps, so to speak. Devin Booker at the 1, Michael Bridges, TJ Warren, Josh Jackson, and Ayton. Just play 4 wings in Ayton and let them run around, let them get destroyed, give them those developmental minutes, and see where you are in a year or two. I never understood the Trevor Ariza pickup.
It reeked of a team that was trying to compete, and they are clearly the worst team in the Western Conference. They might be, if the Kings keep not sucking, the Phoenix is the only clear team that should tank in the West.
Yeah.
Or that could, because
makes the West so, like, it's a gauntlet every single year. But now if you only have one walkover team in the entire conference, it's just ridiculous.
And here there are always surprise tankers. But what makes it so complicated this season is Minnesota's a team that's not going to make the playoffs. They're actually the second worst team in the West right now at only two games under 500. But Tom Thibodeau, if he's there, I don't think that team is just going to bench Taj Gibson, play all the young guys. Dallas, I could see them leaning into a tank, but if they're going to hover close to 500, so
they're 500 right now, right?
Yeah, and they're 7-8. And then the Kings have zero whether or not they fire Dave Yeager. That whole situation is just fucked. That's so weird. But
by the way,
they have no incentive. Foreshadowing. I know there was a question I saw. They have no incentive to tank. The Spurs would be really funny if they did, but I don't know that Greg Popovich is just going to punt on a season when he's where he is at his career and people are talking about him retiring after next year. So it's just where is – you look at the Grizzlies, the Clippers, how far do they have to fade for – them to lean into a tank? And so you look at Phoenix, they look like the only squad that's guaranteed, because they're already inadvertently tanking. They're just not good. And yeah, poor Devin Booker, just the load that he has to shoulder on offense. I'm at the point where I used to criticize him and I'll still eviscerate his defense. It's just not fair what he has to do on the offensive end. Think about what he could do if he had anyone just setting him up sometimes, who wasn't Trevor Ariza, who wasn't Ayton, who wasn't Isaiah Kanan. Like, it's just...
Yeah, that would certainly help him. So I'm glad you made that point about the Kings in your answer about the Suns, because this will be our last question for this mailbag. Mr. Nemo, at Awesome Niemeyer, says, why in the world would the Kings even think about firing their coach? I understand the report was that they want him to play Marvin Bagley more, the front office does, which makes sense to me. I just went on a little bit of a rant about how the Suns should be playing their young guys, and I generally think that's the right approach to take, but that's not really a coach's approach. I think for the most part, every coach wants to win, if for no other reason than to, you know, make your resume look better. Look what I did with this group in Sacramento. If, you know, he's going to get fired at some point. Every NBA coach knows that, and they want to be able to show something in their next job interview.
And the problem with him is he's only signed through next year.
Yeah. And the Kings right now, they're plus 8.4 points per 100 possessions, which is in the 88th percentile. When De'Aaron Fox, Buddy Hield, Nemanja Bjelica, and Willie Cauley-Stein are on the floor, if you swap Bjelica out for Marvin Bagley, they're minus 6.5 points per 100 possessions, which is the 21st percentile. Objectively speaking, if you want to win games, and right now, despite all expectations to the contrary, the Kings are winning games, and they're doing so because, and not entirely because, but in large part because of the way that Dave Yeager is coaching. So that report was pretty wild to me yesterday, although it's kind of par for the course for the Kings at this point. Long story short, what I'm saying is, I guess I get the reasoning behind it, but if you're just looking at a wins and losses standpoint, Dave Yeager has certainly outperformed expectations.
Here's my thing. I don't have a problem. Bjelica was one of the players cited in that report, and I destroyed the Bjelica signing because he's 30. It seems, though, after watching them, after writing a little bit about them, that he is incredibly important to just their floor balance, and they don't have another option like him with someone who can hit threes at that four or even five spot. And if you look at Cauley-Stein's shooting percentages with and without Bjelica, night and day. And this is from Cauley-Stein, who just doesn't operate around the rim when you look this year. So he's important. You look at what he's been able to do in terms of creating space for De'Aaron Fox drives. Here's where Yeager, I don't have a problem with him playing Bjelica the way he is. Here's where Yeager starts to lose me and where I'm gonna side with management.
I know.
Kings fans have pointed out to me that they're out on Scalabissé, and I liked him towards the end of that 16-17 season. But him, there's the notion maybe you should be bringing Harry Giles along slowly. I don't give two shits. You should not be playing Kostas Koufos. In the report, it said that he's disappointed he's not playing Zach Randolph. Are you kidding me? These are not players that you should be playing. And Amon Shumpert, I get you don't have other wing options, and I get he's been important to the defense within their main lineup or their most popular lineup.
They're a lot better with Justin Jackson there than Amon Shumpert.
Well, Justin Jackson needs to learn.
He's not great, but that's their young guy that's, you know, at least impact-wise has been better than Shumpert.
So here's my point. Who are you mad that you want to play? Zach Randolph? Kosa Koufos? Then take a hike. Fire him. Because that's just – no. Do you not agree? Yes, they have.
No, that's true. Yeah,
they have every incentive to tank. Not to tank. Excuse me. Their pick is going to Philly or Boston. And so I get that you want to win. But, like, Marvin Bagley is the second overall pick. You didn't get Luka Doncic, who looks like a transcendent player already. Play him. Play him. And I get what you're saying about coaches. His contract situation probably makes it weird. He's not – if he gets fired – by the Kings for not playing number two overall pick. I don't know how that looks. And
yeah, that's true.
Sacramento has been impressive, but again, you have to play the big picture. You're not here. They did not bring him in and say, we're making the playoffs in 2018, or this wasn't the edict they had to give him. This roster isn't built to win now. They've just been, I don't want to use the word luckily, better than expected. And you lose me at Randolph. You can't, I get, but why does Randolph think he was coming to Sacramento to get playing time? No, you came to Sacramento because you got a crap ton of money that no one else was going to give you. And so probably that you could be a strong locker room presence. I don't know how flawed that thinking is, but it's just, like, that's just what it is. And you know, Kosa Koufos, you don't need to give him 10, 12, 14 minutes a game. No, play Harry Giles more. Play Scalabissé. Play him. What do you have to lose? And do you know why they should be playing these guys? Cauley Stein is about to get a ton of money in free agency from someone. Yeah. Relative to at least, you know, bigs don't make all this money now, but he's going to comfortably probably make $12 million or more per year in restricted free agency. Maybe he's worth keeping, but you're not at a point to win. So rather than just commit or make it so it's necessary to reinvest in him, I'm not saying they shouldn't, but see what you have in these other guys. And you're already playing Bielitsa, who is important. I don't look at this roster and say, I really wish that Kosa Koufos could play more minutes. No.
All right, you've kind of sold me. I don't think Dave Yeager's a great coach, and I think I was probably pretty critical of him last season. I guess I maybe just get where he's coming from. He's playing a lineup that works, and it doesn't include Marvin Bagley. But every point you just made is more than valid.
I never thought I'd be signing with Kings management, and if Yeager's biggest defense right now is just they tried to make me coach Zach LaVine and Buddy Hield and like that, like at the same time with all, like, that's his biggest defense. I don't know that Zach LaVine would have been a great fit in Sacramento regardless of how well he's playing in Chicago right now. So I just don't, again, his contract situation probably makes it weird, but if this is what he's harping on, like, is this just leverage to try and get an extension? Because it's not going to work. Like, Zach, you can't, there's no veteran on this roster that you look at and say, oof, I don't know what I'm going to do if I can't give Amon Shumpert 20-plus minutes a game.
You make very, very good points, for sure. And I think your answer to that question is a good place to end.
Yeah, with me squeaking at the end.
No, it was perfect. If you want to – apologies to any questions that we did not get to. As always, we really sincerely appreciate every question. Like I said at the top, it's you guys generate a lot of fun discussion for us on this podcast. So thank you. Follow Dan Favale on Twitter at Dan Favale, FAVALE. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show is at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA_math. As always, if you haven't rated and reviewed the show, we would sincerely appreciate that on Apple Podcasts. You can now follow us on Spotify as well. Tell your friends and family that they can get to us no matter what kind of phone or tablet they have. We're available all over the place. I think the two biggest ones are probably Apple Podcasts, and then for people that don't have Apple stuff, I think Spotify is a good spot for us now.
Stitcher too, probably.
Stitcher, yeah. Until next time, we leave you with the shout out to Beno Udrih and to should be playing more at the 4, Kyle Anderson.
Saturday, November 24th, Golden Boy Promotions presents Chuck Liddell as he takes on Tito Ortiz in the third and final chapter of their historic rivalry from the Forum. Tickets start at $30 and are available at Ticketmaster.com or by calling 800-745-3000.